It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. And as I thought, sat here a moment ago, thinking about the size of this conference, I thought, We always talk in the Navigators about wanting to have small conferences because we feel that they're so much more effective. And yet we never manage to do this. We always or generally end up with a huge crowd, and they just aren't nearly as valuable as a small group. And so I think it's delightful. I don't know what your thoughts have been, but I think it's delightful that that the group is small. And I trust that you're able to take advantage of this and get lots of personal fellowship with the folks who are speaking and acting as discussion group leaders, because it's a wonderful opportunity to really get down to some basic things and ask questions that you really want to ask. And in fact, I thought, well, perhaps if I could unveil my hay fast enough this morning, we would have a few moments for some questions, and we could open it up for some questions toward the end. So let's plan on doing that. Is it all right to close this? All right. The story is told about the little boy who went to his father one day, and he says, "Dad," he said, "it's not the greatest thing to be the only child in the family, and how about having a little brother or a little sister for me to play with?" And his father said, "Well, son, that's the kind of thing that you pray about." So the little fellow prayed about it for a few nights, consecutively, you know, and then, as children do, he proceeded to forget about it. But a few months later, his mother came home from the hospital. Instead of a little brother or a little sister, she brought home twins. Well, at an appropriate time, the father said to the little guy, "Well, son," he says, "now aren't you glad that you prayed about this?" And the little fellow looked up at his dad and he says, "Yeah, and aren't you glad I quit when I did?" So, Dr. Edward Hale was chaplain of the United States Senate, and one day someone asked him, "Chaplain, do you pray for the senators?" He said, "No, I look at the senators and I pray for the country." Well, our subject this morning is prayer. And some months ago, I began a study in the book of Luke. And much to my surprise, I found that the first chapter of the book of Luke had some very stimulating lessons on the subject of prayer. And it really has to do with the lives of Zacharias and Elizabeth. And I had never thought of this as being a chapter or a portion that would have so many helpful practical lessons on the subject of prayer. But nevertheless, they're here. Let's read a portion of this. You may follow in your translation. I happen to have one this morning that's a little bit different. I often use it simply for a reading program. This is the Moffat translation. Beginning with verse 5, Luke chapter 1. "In the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest called Zechariah who belonged to the division of Abia." It may be spelled differently in your translation. It's spelled a variety of ways. "He had a wife who belonged to the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. They were both just in the sight of God, blameless in their obedience to all the commands and regulations of God, but they had no child, for Elizabeth was barren. Both of them were advanced in years. Now, while he was officiating before God in the due course of his division, it fell to him by lot, as was the custom of the priesthood, to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and burn incense, the mass of the people all remaining in prayer outside. And an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing on the right side of the altar of incense. On seeing him, Zacharias was troubled, and fear fell on him. But the angel said to him, 'Fear not, Zacharias, your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear a son to you, and you must call his name John. It will be joy and gladness for you, and many will rejoice over his birth. For he shall be great in the sight of the Lord. He will drink neither wine nor strong drink. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit from his very birth. He will turn many of the sons of Israel to the Lord their God, He will go in front of him, meaning Christ, with the spirit and power of Elijah, to turn the hearts of fathers to their children, turning the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make a people ready and prepared for the Lord. Zechariah said to the angel, "But how am I to be sure of this? For I am an old man, and my wife is advanced in years." The angel replied, "I am Gabriel. I stand before God. I have been sent to speak to you and to tell you this good news. But you will be silent and unable to speak till the day this happens, because you have not believed what I told you. It will be accomplished in spite of that in due time." Zacharias and Elizabeth, the central characters of this story. Zacharias is a priest and is about to perform a sacred function. The common people are outside the temple. He has entered the inner court, or the court of the priests, to do what? To burn incense. And the burning of incense took place in the morning before the people prayed, and in the evening after they prayed. And the concept here is that the prayers of the people on any given day therefore might ascend up to God, as it were, in an envelope of sweet-smelling savor, the burning of the incense, before the prayers and after the prayers. So Zacharias had entered the inner court, the court of the priest, to perform this sacred act. Expecting to be alone, he suddenly found himself in the presence of someone else, and someone whose appearance was significantly different, so much so that it evoked fear from Zacharias' heart. And we later learn, of course, that this was Gabriel, and that he delivered a prophetic message to Zacharias. Now, I want us to realize that at this particular time in Israel's history, there were approximately 20,000 priests. And they were divided into sections, 24 different sections. And when you figure this out, you realize that there were approximately 800 priests in each section. And it was the practice for these priests to cut their division, came to Jerusalem for 1 week periods twice a year. Twice each year, each section, each division, came to Jerusalem and they ministered in the temple for 1 week. Now we might ask, well, what did they do the other 50 weeks of the year? Was this all vacation? Well, no, it wasn't. There was only one temple, and that, of course, was in Jerusalem, where they burnt sacrifice and made sacrifice. Burnt offerings and sacrifices were made in the temple only. But throughout Israel, there were synagogues, and the priests taught in the synagogues, and people prayed. They gathered for prayer and the teaching of the word. So during 50 weeks of the year, they were basically teachers. And then twice each year, they came and ministered at the temple in Jerusalem. And when they arrived, by some means, the Bible says that by lot, their duties were determined. So when they would arrive, they would draw, a slip out of a hat or something, and this would identify their performance that week. And if you figure this out, you'll realize that many of the priests in each section probably went his entire lifetime without ever having the privilege of entering this inner court and burning incense. So what does this say to us? Well, it says that it was not coincidence that brought Zechariah to this appointed place at this appointed hour. But it was God. God was guiding, controlling, arranging the routine affairs of life, of this man's life, in order to accomplish his will. It's a wonderful thing to see the hand of God at work in the lives of his people. It's even more wonderful when we see the evidence of God's hand at work in our own individual lives. And we can be sure that he does this. For instance, in 2 Timothy 1:9. Paul writes and he says, "Who hath saved us and called us with an holy calling, not according to our works, but according to his own purpose, his plan, his purpose and grace, which was given us in Christ Jesus before the world began." Before the world began. Before Jesus Christ created the world that you and I are familiar with, God had a plan for Zechariah and Elizabeth. And he has a plan for your life and my life as well. Perhaps you've sometimes looked in vain for the evidence of God's hand on your life. Perhaps you've fellowshipped with other Christians and listened to them tell about answers to prayer, tell about experiences where God gave them witnessing opportunities, tell about occasions when God led them. And as you listened to these people, you evaluated your own life and you wondered, well, why don't I have more of these experiences in my life? If you do that, then don't. Don't permit yourself to do this. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 10:12 that comparisons are unwise. And we don't have to think about this very long to realize that comparisons will produce either pride or discouragement. When we compare our lives with others, it gets us into trouble. Well, like Zacharias, I believe that you and I are often unaware of God's intervention in our affairs until at some later time we look back and then we see the pattern of how he has led. But in the process, we are often unaware that God is manipulating the circumstances. During the summer of 1965, we took 25 young people to Europe and the Middle East and teamed them up with some nationals that we were working with in that part of the world. And together they worked throughout the summer months in reaching other young people. And we took a team of 7 Americans and teamed them up with 7 Arabs in the city of Beirut. These Arabs could speak English. They were all converts from the Navigator Ministry. And we spent the summer together down there ministering in 2 or 3 of the countries, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. One day, I came out of the school that we were using as sort of a base of operations in Beirut. And I walked to the car that was parked along the street and was in the process of unlocking it and getting in when an elderly man came up to me, rather shabbily dressed, and in very broken English, he began to tell me this tale of woe. And I thought, well, what he wants is money. Now, when he gets through with his story, what are you going to do? And I was in the process of making this decision when I realized that he wasn't asking for money, he was asking for employment. And he told me that he had come from the country of Jordan to the city of Beirut, that someone had promised him employment, but when he arrived, the job had already been taken. And now for several days he had wandered looking for work without finding any. He had spent his money. He had sold his coat and his other possessions for food. He had not eaten for 2 days, and he was asking for employment. Well, in his rather broken English, and I was sure that he and I would have difficult communicating, I decided, well, if this man's story is authentic, how could I ever discover that it was or was not with our poor communications? So I'll go back into the school and get one of the young men that we're working with and have him come out and talk to this man. And if it seems legitimate and honest, then we'll help him. So I headed back into the school, and just as I got to the steps, out came one of the young men, Samir Zahir. And I told Samir briefly what had happened. So he came on out, and he talked with this man probably for 10 minutes. Seemed like an endless conversation. And then he turned to me and interpreted for me what their conversation had been about. And he discovered that this old man had once worked for Samir's father, and that when Samir was only 3 years old, this old man knew him. Now, Samir and his family had lived in Tel Aviv, and they were driven from their homes when the Jews occupied that part of Israel or Palestine. They fled. His father lost his business and all of this. But at that time, his father had been employing this old man. And he too had fled and was living in the country of Jordan. And we discovered that he had been in contact with Christian missionaries. And whether or not he had yet made his commitment to Christ was not clear to us. But we were able to put additional tracts and booklets in his hand to read. We were able to witness to him again. And we were able to supply him sufficient funds so that he could return to his home. And as I thought about this, I thought, well, here is the hand of God on the life of an old man who perhaps has not yet made his commitment to Christ. But nevertheless, it was the hand of God reaching down and directing that old man in the midst of a city of a population of perhaps several million people and bringing him to someone who could help him and meet his material needs. But to me, it spoke of the grace of God and also the way in which God manipulates the routine affairs of our lives in order to work out his will. This is what he did with Zacharias. This is what he does with us. We're often unaware of it. Ephesians 2, 9 and 10 in the Phillips translation expresses this. It says, the fact is that what we are, we owe to the hand of God upon us. We are born afresh in Christ and born to do those good deeds that he planned for us to do. And these experiences stand as monuments in our memory to the fact that God is personally interested in us as individuals, and in many cases has answered our prayer. This was true in Zacharias' case, because it was prayer that had brought Zacharias to that inner court at just the right moment. And we know this is true because Gabriel's opening statement was, "Your prayer has been heard." And in my opinion, had it not been for prayer, Zacharias would never have been there. Had it not been for prayer, there never would have been a John the Baptist. And that's an opinion. Andrew Murray says, what God wills to accomplish on earth needs prayer as its indispensable condition. Andrew Murray is saying God's will cannot be accomplished apart from prayer. We see a good illustration of this in the Old Testament. You'll remember that Daniel, in his experiences through the reading of the scriptures, Daniel knew that Israel was to be in bondage for 70 years and that the city of Jerusalem was to be desolate. This was according to the prophecy of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 25:12. Daniel also knew that the 70 years were up. And what did he do? Did he conduct himself as a spectator, we might say, in a stadium, just standing back, waiting and watching to see this fulfilled? No. What did he do? He prayed. He went to prayer. He began to beseech God that this prophecy would in fact be fulfilled. And I think Daniel understood something about prayer that perhaps many of us don't fully realize. We do not like to accept the fact that God's will is conditioned on prayer. Somehow this does violence to our concept of an infinite God. In James 4:2, there's this thought ye have not because ye ask not, or as the New English Bible says it, you do not get what you want because you do not pray for it. Or if you do, you pray for it from wrong motives. Either the lack of prayer or the wrong motives can hinder answers to prayer. Now, Zacharias and Elizabeth had prayed for a child for years, and with, I'm sure, agonizing prayer. This was all they were asking for. No special endowments, just the child. But I believe that God had far more in mind than just a son or a daughter for Zechariah and Elizabeth. He wanted a very special man for a very special purpose, and in ways only God understands, I believe that he evokes from human hearts the prayer necessary for his will to be accomplished. You see, he deprived Zechariah and Elizabeth of their heart's desire, of the one thing they wanted most of all. For years he deprived them of this, and as a result of this, he evoked from them these prayers. And then he used this prayer to fulfill his will. We have another good illustration of this in the story of Hannah. And as a result of her prayers and her barrenness for years, God also produced for himself another great man of God, Samuel. But it was her prayer, it was her plight, it was her agony that I think produced the kind of man that God wanted. You read this, you can find it in 1 Samuel, the first chapter, verses, just in the first chapter there. What do we learn from this? I think one of the lessons we learn is that we should never give up. As long as we are concerned, as long as we have a burden, we must never stop praying. The Navigators came to Colorado Springs in 1953. That was when we purchased Glen Eyrie. And at that time, there was a prominent businessman in Colorado Springs who was a great help to the Navigators. He's pagan, about as pagan as a man can be. He's the president of one of the banks and very prominent in fundraising campaigns and in many of the social activities of Colorado Springs. And a number of us have had a concern for this man and have prayed for him down through the years. And sometimes I think, Rod, why do you continue to pray for him? There's not the slightest evidence that he's making any progress or developing any interest in the things of God. But this encourages me to keep praying. God's will needs prayer as its indispensable condition. Another wonderful lesson from the lives of Zechariah and Elizabeth. We have here a couple who for years lived with personal tragedy. Now, today we don't think of a childless couple in such drastic terms, but verse 36 tells us that Elizabeth was known as the barren woman. You see, some women are known for their hospitality, and some women are known for their good cooking or their sewing, or any one of a dozen different things. To her friends and to her relatives, Elizabeth was known as, this was her reputation, as a barren woman. There was a saying in those days, coined by the Jewish rabbis, describing seven types of people supposedly excommunicated from God, and the list began like this: a Jew who has no wife, or a Jew who has a wife and no child. You remember the story of Jacob and his two wives? Leah had provided Jacob with six sons and one daughter, and Rachel was barren. And in Genesis 30, we read about this. Rachel prayed. She agonized over this problem. She poured out her heart before God, And then we read, then God remembered Rachel and answered her pleading and made it possible for her to have children. And now, for the first time, she became pregnant and bore a son, and she said, God has taken away my reproach, my disgrace, and my humiliation. You see, God's will for Zechariah and Elizabeth brought a stigma into their lives. It brought a cross to bear instead of a blessing to enjoy. It brought the disapproval of others. It brought the disapproval of relatives and friends. And don't you know that those neighbors often talked among themselves, and they would say, you know, Elizabeth has told me that they have prayed for a child for years, but you know, there must be something wrong with them. God answers the prayers of those whose lives please Him. There must be some hidden sin in their lives, because you know, all these years they have prayed for a child, and she's barren. God's will. A stigma instead of a blessing to enjoy. So often we Christians feel that if we are in God's will, there will be nothing but blessing. We were talking about this the other day, and Lauren Sanney said, well, you know, years ago when I first became a Christian, someone shared a little coined phrase with me, and I thought it was so great I preached on it repeatedly. And the phrase was, out of the will of God and into trouble. He said, then years later I realized how unscriptural this really was. Being in God's will can mean misunderstanding, can bring loneliness, can bring heartache, can mean bearing a cross or a burden for which you have no plausible explanation. Perhaps this is familiar ground to you. Perhaps you know the burden of disapproval. Perhaps you know the burden of some other kind of heartache. Well, may we be encouraged by Hebrews 5:8. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. And someone has expressed the thought this way, God's will for his son was first a cross and then a crown. Can we expect less? Probably not. Then another lesson we learned from this dear couple, they did not allow this personal problem, this disappointment, to erode their relationship with God. They did not allow resentment or bitterness or self-pity to develop in their lives. They did not give up. But instead, they diligently maintained their walk with God. Luke verse 6, of course, chapter 1. We read this a few moments ago. But verse 6 tells us they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinance of the Lord blameless. And there is a tendency when the pressure really mounts to give up or to allow self-pity or resentment to crowd in. I was talking a couple of months ago with a Christian leader. He's gone through some very extremely difficult problems. He struck a man with his automobile and the man died. There were other pressures that were intense. He can't drive a car now. He just can't manage emotionally to drive. And just one thing after another. And as he was sharing this with me, he said, you know, the thing that startles me most is that inwardly I find that my response to all of this pressure is just to pack up and move out and give up. He says, just to completely change my circumstances, move the family, move out of my present responsibilities and job. He says, this to me is the most attractive thing, humanly speaking, that I could do at this time. And he said, it scares me to realize that this is my response to want to quit and to want to give up. But that's what we do. We had a long-distance call just last week from someone who's very dear to us. And this person has been having some real problems trying to live the Christian life, trying to get help and not finding anyone who would really take an interest and help. And so she's given up. That's exactly what's happened. She's given up. And she's decided to marry someone who's a non-Christian. The non-Christians welcome her into their fellowship with open arms. And the Christians that she's been trying to try in with, are in a collegiate ministry. And she's not a collegian. And she wasn't able to get help from them. And what is the result? She's given up. And this can happen to any one of us. Zacharias and Elizabeth didn't give up. Year after year, they stuck it out. We have a tremendous example of this in the example of Job. You'll remember that this man had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep. He had 3,000 camels. He had 500 pair of oxen, 500 she-asses, plus a great many servants. And in chapter 1 of the book of Job, we read that this man was the greatest man in all the East. And what happened? He lost his 7 sons and his daughters. He lost everything that he owned. God allowed Satan to take all of these things out of Job's life. And then later on, he allowed Satan to smite Job with physical affliction and terrible suffering. And one day Job's wife came to him in the 2nd chapter. She said, Job, are you still holding to your loyalty? Well, for heaven's sakes, why don't you just curse God and die? That's the vernacular translation. And Job said to her, you are talking like an impious fool. Are we to take good from God's hand and not evil too? In all of this, Job sinned not with his lips. And then God restored to Job his wealth. So the lesson we learn is that we must never allow the problems or the disappointments or the heartaches that enter our lives to destroy or to erode our relationship to Jesus Christ. We must maintain that at all costs. And how does this relate to prayer? Well, it relates intimately to prayer. Because as E.M. Bounds says, prayer does not stand alone. It is not an isolated performance. Prayer stands in closest connection with all the duties of ardent piety. If we are to pray effectively, then we must live effectively. Our prayer life and our day-by-day life is so intimately related that what we are in the routine of life is what we are in our prayer life. If we are living holy, godly lives, then we are praying in a similar manner. If we are careless in our daily living, if we are undisciplined in our daily living, we are equally undisciplined and ineffectual in our prayer. Well, there we have two or three lessons from the lives of Zacharias and Elizabeth on the subject of prayer. From these, we learn that prayer is essential to the work of God, to the will of God. It is absolutely essential. Then secondly, that there are crosses to bear before there are crowns to wear. And then we have not fully prayed until we have fully obeyed. Would you like to discuss some points that were brought out here? How's our time, Russ?
15 minutes,
Rob. Well, we could take a few minutes for any questions. As we proceeded through this little study on Luke 1, was there something that you would like to come back to and add a thought, a comment, maybe your personal experience, or ask a question concerning it? If not, then why don't we be dismissed? Can we do that? Just have a word of prayer? Is that what we should do? All right.